This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show where every time we remind you that no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women that have done things maybe you can't even imagine for the sake of the freedom that you and I enjoy each and every day. We want to honor our veterans for their service, for the sacrifices they've made on our behalf. We want to make sure that their stories are not forgotten so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we sure learn a lot about what life was like way back when and the things that our veterans have been through. And we're going to enjoy a ride today with a Marine Corps veteran of World War II. You've heard about battles like Guadalcanal and Tarawa and Saipan and Tinian. And this young man was there for all of them. And boy, was he a young man at the time. We're going to touch on that with 87-year-old Jack Venables of Merced, California. Not too long ago, we had him heading off to Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight. Maybe we'll talk about that before we're done. But let's talk about the early years. You're one of four children, and all your siblings were born in Bakersfield. How did you end up being born in Tulare County down in Visalia, California?
My mother was pregnant when she and her husband, my father, went to Visalia to visit the Venables family, his father and mother. Anyway, she delivered while they were visiting there. Of course, they didn't go to hospitals in those days. She was delivered at home. I've never lived in Visalia. I went back to Bakersfield, which was a family home, and I spent most of my youth there in Bakersfield with my brother and two sisters.
And Bakersfield, I know, is where you would meet your wife of nearly 67 years. But before any of that happened, and before World War II got underway, you learned a little bit about some military history in your own family. How did you find out that your father was a World War I veteran? Because I guess you didn't know for a while, huh?
We were traveling, my brother and I, with my father and his friend, and we'd gone up into Oregon to visit his sister, my aunt. And on the way back to California, we ran out of gas, and he ran out of money to pay for any fuel. And they pulled off the road near a place called Hunter's Creek, just on the border. It's still in Oregon, but close to California. When we drove in, there were fish popping, trout just popping out of the water. So we had a good source of supply of food. Cows came by every morning, herded out to pasture by a dog. On the way home, when the dog was taking them back to the farm, he would get milk from the cow. So we had fish and we had milk and we did very well. Anyway, we went across the road, a highway, and there was a farm there. And we offered to move the farmer's irrigation pipe for him that he'd been drawing water out of a creek nearby. We said we'd be glad to move your pipe for you if we could ride your horses. So he did let us ride the horses, and we had a ball, my brother and I. We raced those horses. We ran through water. We also came to a fence, and Jim said, let's jump the horses over the fence. Needless to say, the horses stopped before we got to the fence, but we didn't.
Uh-huh. So you went flying head over heels over the fence?
Yes, we did. So that was our experience. But we took the horse by the campsite where we were. My dad said, well, let me try it, to ride the horse. So he jumped on the horse and took off. And I hadn't realized that he was familiar with horses at all or could ride. Well, it turned out that he, during World War I, was in the cavalry. He knew how to ride, and it was beautiful. That's how I learned.
Well, and I've had so many veterans tell me that the experience of living through the Depression really kind of colored their perspective. And when they got into the war, they had a little different perspective than maybe someone today going into that situation would have had. Looking back, do you feel like you took less for granted because of what you'd been through?
I think so. I don't know how to explain it, but yeah, you become a realist.
And you would face some pretty tough situations in World War II as well. But let's talk about the way America was drawn into World War II, because everyone seems to remember that everyone who was alive on December 7th, 1941, seems to remember where he was and how he found out. How did you learn that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor?
By the radio. Everything was by radio in those days, and the newspapers, of course. But we didn't have money to buy a newspaper, but we did have a radio, and that's how I heard about it. Matter of fact, I'd been in an accident and was sitting at home recuperating from the accident. I had a fractured skull and a broken arm. I had a bicycle. There's a bluff outside of Bakersfield, and about four of us guys went out there on our bicycles. And there were dares. I'll dare you to ride down the hill. Well, I took up on the dare, and I ended up in an old car body down at the bottom. And my head was, I had 19 stitches and a broken arm. That was a terrible experience.
Yeah, for being 15 years old and almost killing yourself in a bike accident. And now you find out America's at war. Did that news jolt you a little bit? Did you fathom what was going on there?
I was 14 at the time of the accident. Okay. So I had recuperated, and I found out about the war while sitting at the radio recuperating. And my brother had joined the Marine Corps in June of 41. He was in the Marine Corps, and he was the first. He was in the 8th Marines, and his outfit was the first off the West Coast. And they headed for Samoa because they thought the Japanese were going to attack Samoa as well. Anyway, it wasn't long before I was told by the recruiting sergeant that he would be able to put me in the same outfit that my brother was in. And I said, well, I'm not quite 17. He said, don't worry about it. He said, I'll tell you where you can use as a birthplace because the Hall of Records is burned down. They can't prove or disprove your age. So I went in at age 15, as did my brother. We were 13 months apart. I was the younger one of the two. I shipped out October 19th of 1942 and headed for New Zealand.
I think this is interesting. I've had other veterans tell me that they lied about their age, or they got their parents to sign for them, or this or that. But I haven't had anyone tell me that he was able to find a loophole of a small town in Texas where the Hall of Records had burnt down. I guess there's no way to count how many people did this, but it sounds like this was a fairly common thing with that particular Marine Corps recruiter, that he pointed people to fill it out this way and you'll get in?
I think so with young people, of course, younger than legal age for the military.
And what was that town in Texas?
Farwell. And it's interesting because when I was overseas and I was in a hospital due to malaria, it's a field hospital, it was in a tent actually, and some guy was yelling, "Hey Tex, hey Tex." And it was one of the corpsmen. I didn't realize he was calling me. And until I finally turned around and realized it was he that was trying to get a hold of me. So anyway, it was kind of funny at the time.
So you'd never even set foot in Texas, and here you are listed that way. And what possessed you? I know your brother was in already, and obviously you guys had a great relationship, but 15 years old to want to go fight a war. Where did that come from?
Stupidity.
Had you known, huh?
Had I known. No, I'm kidding. I don't know why. I wanted to be with my brother, mainly. We grew up together, and we were real good friends.
And I know we're going to talk some about your brother in the course of this program, because he had quite a record of service to our country himself. But I'm sure some parents out there are thinking, man, my kid's 15. I wouldn't even dream of letting him do this. Did either your mother or father try to stop you from going in?
Well, my mother signed for me. My folks were separated and eventually divorced. So we were living with my mother at the time. We were truants from school, so I think she was kind of happy to get rid of us.
She thought it might do you some good?
Not thinking about the war and where we would be sent or anything.
So you got shipped to New Zealand, and this is not a hot war zone at the time. I imagine you were probably greeted with welcome arms, huh?
The Japanese fleet was heading south, and they thought New Zealand might be attacked. So that's why we were sent there. And when we came into the Wellington Harbor, people were hanging out the windows, waving their sheets and shirts, and everything was white. It was quite a greeting, and when we finally docked, the women had a long table, and they had donuts and coffee and tea and soft drinks. Very, very hospitable people. Real tickled to see the Marines show up.
I can imagine so, and I don't want to skip over anything. Do you have any vivid memories from training or the trip over there that really stand out to you now, that maybe raised your eyebrows a little bit?
It's interesting you'd ask that, because it was funny because no one knew where New Zealand was or what it was. Of course, there are a lot of young guys aboard the ship.
And you hadn't been going to school.
That's right. Well, I'd gone to two years of school, almost 2 years, not quite. And I wasn't always in school, so anyway. We had a guy that played the guitar, and he could make that sing, really sing. And so we had a lot of sing-alongs with him playing the guitar as we were aboard ship. And it's a long journey by ship, especially we were on the Matsonia, which is the Matson line. My brother shipped out on the Lorelei. which was a sister ship. We were zigzagging all the way to avoid submarine, so it took forever, it seemed like, to get there.
So you're over here in New Zealand. You're still a teenage boy in the Marine Corps. How eager were you to track down your brother and find Jim out there on the other side of the world?
They were in Guadalcanal while we were in New Zealand. And I didn't see Jim until we got to Guadalcanal. And he was in the infantry, and I was in the artillery, 75 pack howitzers, which is about a 3-inch gun. And he came back knowing that we were there, and he came and we had a visit. And boy, it was good to see. He was healthy, had quite a beard.
Well, speaking of, I think you have a story about beards and shaving and being pre-shaving stage, you had to fake it a little bit, didn't you?
Well, this was in boot camp when the DI, the drill instructor, came up to me, and I mean, his nose is practically up to my nose, and he asked me, he said, "Have you shaved today, mister?" And I said, "No, sir, I don't have a beard." He said, "By God, you got fuzz on your face, and you'll shave every day from here on out. You got that, mister?" So I used to get up early in the morning before anybody else got down to the head, and I used to put a soap on my face and shave. Even though I had nothing to shave, it was kind of stupid.
Did any of your buddies, fellow soldiers, ever find out how young you really were?
I never told a soul.
You mentioned getting to Guadalcanal, and the fighting had already been going there, and your brother had been involved in it, and then you come in this artillery unit. What did you see? Because I imagine you hadn't seen anything like that before, and I would imagine there are some things that got your attention. So what were those things that caught your eye and wowed you a little bit when you arrived?
When we were pulling up and getting ready to weigh anchor, I looked over the side and I could see the island. It was beautiful. It was so green. You would never thought a war was going on there. That was a palm, coconut palm tree orchard, and a lot of undergrowth. First night on Guadalcanal was probably one of the scariest, because it was dark, and I mean, when the moon's not out on Guadalcanal, it is really dark. You know, we're a bunch of raw recruits, and somebody, they had a mess hall right close there, and somebody had hit the pots and pans, and they were banging against each other, and we thought, my God, they're attacking. So that was a thrill a minute, I'll tell you.
Yeah, I imagine you probably didn't sleep all that well that night.
Not at all. Not at all. You could see a bush out there and you'd think somebody was there. It was kind of spooky.
There, and I'm sure with all the other battles you were involved in, there were plenty of these moments, but this is when you're still first getting baptized, so to speak, in this warfare. Were you ever finding yourself in awe of the magnitude of what was happening, the number of ships, the number of bombers or fighter planes going over, the amount of smoke and shells in the air? What do you remember about that as someone who had never experienced that before at the time?
There were two things that really stood out in Guadalcanal for me. Number one was the shelling. They had a 155 or some large, anyway, a large cannon that they'd fire every night. So that was spooky. The other was Wash Machine Charlie. There'd be a plane flying over at nighttime. Every night, he'd drop a bomb and then leave. We wouldn't see him again. They had a sea battle, and they sunk a lot of our ships, and it cut off our supply line for a while, so we didn't have any food coming in. So we were eating little chocolate bars that you carried on your belt, and they were for emergencies, and they were supposed to be loaded with all kinds of proteins and whatever to keep you alive. So we were starting to eat those, and then they finally got some food on board. The Army came in, too, and that was a big help, because they fed the Army very well. And Buddy and I were walking by. We hadn't been eating. We'd eaten coconuts, and we'd eaten the D-bars, and we walked by, and the guys were lined up for their breakfast, the Army. Somebody said, "Well, they're going to have hotcakes today." He said, "Oh, God, not hotcakes again." And he threw down his mess kit. And my buddy and I got in line real quick.
We'll take those hot cakes, no problem. And I know we've got a lot of ground to cover still, and this is just your first battle you were involved in. But did you find yourself scared? Were you too young and inexperienced to get scared? What was that like for a teenager in this huge battle in the Pacific?
Probably the death. There were Japanese bodies along the roads, or one road, actually. And, you know, you'd sit down and eat your whatever you're going to eat, and you're sitting right next to a dead Japanese. And, of course, they're rotting. And in retrospect, it was kind of a horrible situation. But I remember that very well. The other thing about Guadalcanal, when they were getting ready to secure the island, they sent army with mules up to the hills, and they sent us on an LCM around the other end of the island. And we had just one battery of guns, that's four guns, and a small contingent of infantry in front of us. Went around the island, unloaded, and there was an officer who was carrying a 45, and he was wandering off someplace, and he shot it a few times and came back screaming that he had gotten a Jap. So we thought they were very close to us. But it turns out that we were overlooking a place called Cape Esperance, and the Japanese were loading board submarines down there, and we just blasted the hell out of them. And the submarine didn't get away, and neither did the guys that were trying to board it.
Because of your 75-millimeter guns that you unloaded on them with?
Exactly.
It's time for our first break, but remember, again, as we listen to Jack Venables tell this story, when he was on Guadalcanal, engaging in that battle, experiencing all the things that he just described, he was only 16 years old. We'll try to find out more about his duties during World War II when Hometown Heroes continues next, right after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.